Have you ever felt like that you have a problem on your hands and that there's a situation with your child that you don't know how to deal with and it seems so hard and it seems hopeless? Maybe you have a child who is angry or hateful or jealous or vindictive, or maybe you find that this child is actively working against your parental interests. Maybe it seems like that he is oblivious to his own sins and even holds grudges against you as parents for supposed unfairness. Maybe you find that he vacillates between right and wrong. Sometimes he'll choose the right, sometimes he'll choose the wrong. And he's easily swayed to join evil, even though he may not be the original planner. Maybe you find that he's hard-hearted or calloused and doesn't mind how much he wounds other people. Or he might not have concern about actually ruining someone else's life. Maybe he's older and he has companionship with unbelievers of the opposite sex. Maybe he's sensual, even dabbling in immorality. Sometimes parents find that their child is deceitful and they can't trust what he says. Or maybe he's impulsive. And sometimes they might find that their child is judging other people harshly while allowing worse things for himself. Maybe you've experienced a situation where your child failed to fulfill responsibilities, and then when problems arose, had really absurd ideas on how to compensate for those problems. Sometimes people jump to wrong conclusions regarding the motives of other people. And maybe you find that your child is performing poorly on jobs assigned and is legalistic, maybe isolates himself from the family, and you see yourself alarmed that he's assimilating the wickedness of the culture around him, and you begin to say to yourself, this child is practically an adult. How can I deal with him? It looks hopeless. Did you know there's a biblical family with all of these problems? And that's what we're going to look at tonight. This story comes into focus, Genesis 37. It's the story of Jacob's sons. Here's what this family was like. These 10 older brothers, they lived in opposition to their father. Joseph, you remember, gave an evil report. That does not mean it was evil that he gave the report. He correctly gave a correct report of them, and they were evil. They were so angry regarding the special coat that Joseph had received from his father and regarding his dreams that they were ready to kill their own brother. They had nursed grievances. That resulted in hatred, and that grew into a murderous intent. Remember, in the New Testament, it says, he who hates his brother is a murderer. Notice, when you see bad things in the early stages in your family, take them seriously. Don't just think, this child will grow out of it. Things never grow smaller. And these brothers could not stand the idea that Joseph, a person of integrity, would rule over them. So they had perverted solutions. They could kill him, or maybe they could sell him to Egypt. There was no thought of repenting of their own character flaws, which produced the hatred. These men were hard-hearted. After they threw Joseph in the pit, intending to kill him, they didn't lose their appetite at all. They sat down to eat. And then, you remember, they deliberately deceived their father regarding their brother, making him think that his favorite son was dead, and then when he wept unconsolably, they rose up to comfort him, miserable scoundrels. Reuben was vacillating. He was called weak as water. He defiled his father's bed. He was right in wanting to deliver Joseph back to the father, but then he was wrong in going on with the conspiracy instead of revealing it. He could have revealed it and sent an allegation to Egypt or wherever and bought Joseph back for twice the price. And then later on in his life, Reuben gave the absurd suggestion in chapter 42, verse 37, that if he didn't bring Benjamin back, that Jacob could kill his two grandsons. Well, what grandfather would want to kill his two grandsons because the son didn't bring another son back? Judah was legalistic. Judah said, well, what profit is it for us to kill our brother? Chapter 37, verses 26 and 27. Let's get some money, because after all, he's our flesh. Doesn't that sound pious? He didn't care what happened to Joseph, what kind of miserable life he would have, or whether he would die as a slave. Let's just fix this problem and get some money besides, because after all, he's our flesh. We wouldn't want to treat him too bad. And Judah isolated himself from the family. That's chapter 38, verse 1. He married a Canaanite named Shua. He failed in training his own children. His firstborn was so wicked that God killed him. His name was Ur. And then God killed Onan. He was wicked also. And then Judah himself was a deceiver regarding Tamar. He led her on, but never planned to give Shelah to him. He was immoral with his daughter-in-law, and he was ready to burn Tamar when he was the other guilty party. You see, this gives you a flavor of how Canaanite Jacob's elder sons had become. Now, the solution to this mess gives us hope. In fact, you might like to glance at Romans chapter 15. Verse 4. For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Remember, these stories in the Old Testament and also material in the New is just not some boring Bible account. This is something that we can learn from so that we can have comfort and hope. You see, sometimes parents lose hope. But remember, the men we're talking about are grown men. They're set in their ways and they're vicious. And I dare say that these brothers were worse material than what most parents have to deal with, even if they have a very difficult problem child. What we're going to be talking about tonight is hard nuts to crack. Notice what happens here. Joseph is the one who actually brings the solution. Now, he is an unlikely source because Joseph is next to the youngest. That means he has no seniority. He has no credentials as far as they're concerned. And that reminds us sometimes parents have lost credibility with their child. Joseph is hated by the older ones. He is sold into oblivion. And I think these 10 brothers were harder nuts to crack than most modern teenagers. What are the keys for success in dealing with these hard nuts to crack? Well, first of all, Joseph had a relationship with the Father. Now, what we learn from that is we need a relationship with our Father. Now, I want you to see what's happening with Joseph and his relationship to his Father. First of all, he is concerned about his Father's interests. You know, I think this is one area where many parents sow seeds of destruction in their families. They are not primarily concerned about God's interests. That is critical. Joseph was concerned about the Father's interests. He was ready to do his Father's bidding. His Father said, go check up on your brothers. And he sent him from Hebron to Shechem. That's a long trek through Canaanite territory. And Canaanite territory during that era in history was awash with sexual perversion and debauchery. Now, would you trust a 17-year-old to go by foot through that kind of territory to go check up on his brothers? Jacob could trust Joseph to do that. You remember the statement that Jesus makes, if you love me, keep my commandments? Here was Joseph keeping his father's commandments. And when Joseph got to Shechem, he did not say, well, I don't see him anywhere, and go back to Hebron to his father and say, I did the best I could. He wandered around there a little bit and he talked to somebody and they said, well, the brothers went to Dothan. So then Joseph goes to Dothan and finds his brothers. Do you see what that tells us? God expects us to use our own creativity to promote his program. Furthermore, if you're going to have success in dealing with a hard nut to crack, you need to live a life of personal spiritual growth. And that means, for one thing, refuse to be in despair regarding the injustices of life. Again and again, Joseph's right behavior resulted in disaster. But he walked in integrity. You see, he refused temptation. You know, when he was serving his father Jacob, he refused the temptations of the Canaanites all around him. He reported correctly what his brothers were like. And when he was sold into slavery at Potiphar's house, he lived in integrity, so much so that Potiphar put him in charge of everything. And then there was no compromise with Potiphar's wife. You know, she was making the offers again and again and again and again. And he could have said, well, you know, I'm lonely, I'm this and I'm that, and whatever excuse you want to make. But he didn't. It wasn't the question in his mind, could I get by with this? It was a question of, this would be a sin against God, and so it's not a contest. It is out of the question. And you know, if you as a parent want to have success with a hard nut to crack, then that's the kind of attitude you need to have about God's standards for your life. Notice that Joseph had not assimilated the Canaanite view of local gods. You see, the Canaanites thought, here's the god of this, and the god of this, and the god of this. So naturally, if you're way down in Egypt, your god from back home wouldn't be an issue. He had not assimilated that kind of view. He knew that the God of heaven had created the heaven and the earth, and that included not only Canaan, but also Egypt. And also notice this. This young man was accountable to God. I believe there's a fad going on these days about accountability, where people love to be accountable to someone, and they want someone else to be accountable to them. You know what I believe we should be doing? Helping one another be more accountable to God. After all, if someone is clever, would they be able to fool their accountability person? Of course. But nobody can fool God. And we need to help one another be more accountable to God, more aware of what he wants, more interested in what he wants. And Joseph, who was his accountability person that he met with once a week? It was God. Probably more often than once a week. Furthermore, in terms of living a life of personal spiritual growth, it means applying yourself to the lessons of life regardless of the circumstances. Imagine when Joseph went down into Potiphar's house and did what he was supposed to do, the best of his ability. Potiphar soon saw that this man has ability. I want to put him in charge of things. And notice that Joseph is managing Potiphar's slaves for Potiphar's benefit, not for his own. Now that's a difficult assignment. Here's this fellow that's transported to Egypt when he's 17. He will be younger than most of the slaves, probably, and all of a sudden he's elevated to be managing those slaves. How do you think those old guys like that? Probably not too much. You know what Joseph is learning? He's learning how to deal with hard nuts to crack. And so, he did what he could to the best of his ability, even though the prophet was going to Potiphar. And you know, when you do that, God gives you insight. Chapter 39, verse 2, it says that the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. Well, you know the story. Potiphar's wife wanted to seduce Joseph. And she was not successful. And then because she was not successful, she lied against him and accused him of the very thing that he refused to do. And Potiphar became angry and threw Joseph into jail. But God's evaluation of that was chapter 39, verse 23. The keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hands all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. That's verse 22. And then verse 23, the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. That shows that God's ideas of prosperity are quite different from ours. Now imagine what this would be like. Here's this young man thrown into jail for a false accusation, and he is made the manager of the rest of the jailbirds. Now those guys probably were not too nice. Some of them might have been conspirators. Some of them might have been downright evil. Some of them might have been jailed for political reasons. We don't know what all the reasons were, but you can imagine they weren't a very happy bunch. And probably a lot of them had some pretty vicious things behind them in their character. And he has to manage these fellows. Now that's quite an assignment. He's probably younger than most of them. How could this young man ever last in a jail full of crooks? And the answer is this: he was getting insight from God. That's how. So you see what he's doing? He is applying himself to the lessons of life. When he gets done with one educational institution, the Lord sends him to another one, higher level institution. Externally, of course, it's a lower level. But internally, in terms of what you've got to manage, it's a lot harder. And so he was applying himself to the lessons of life. Furthermore, in terms of living a life of personal growth, a parent needs to recognize that it's God, not self, that's the key to understanding. When you get to chapter 40, verse 8, as he is interpreting these dreams for these two men, he says, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" You see what he knew? He knew that God is the one who gives understanding. And he makes a similar statement in chapter 41, verse 16, to Pharaoh. He says to Pharaoh, "It is not me, God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." Now, apart from God, Joseph's life was totally incomprehensible. In fact, Genesis 39:23, which we've already looked at, seems so contradictory. Every time he succeeds, he goes down further. And we see, we need to learn this as parents, that wisdom we must have must come from God. And I believe that's one of the reasons why we need to spend a lot of time in this book. You see, God is active in history. Joseph talked about that. Chapter 41, verse 25. Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do." And then verse 28. "This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do." And then verse 32. "And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." You see, Joseph is confident that God is active in history. Now, Joseph could say this by faith, even though many times it looked like God had forsaken him and God was silent. In other words, even if God is silent, he is active. And in living a life of personal spiritual growth, it is going to mean we need to focus not on self, but on ministry to other people. Joseph did not wallow in self-pity regarding the unfair things in life. He was in jail, and he noticed when his fellow inmates were sad, and he was concerned about it. And he asked them why they're sad, and they told him they had these dreams, nobody's there to interpret them. So he took time to hear and interpret their dreams. Now, that ministry to other people was the key to his ultimate exaltation. You see, the restored butler eventually reported to Pharaoh, but God delayed the reward until just the right time. Now, if it had been done immediately, Joseph may have been released and then returned to Canaan to his father. Furthermore, if we want to succeed dealing with hard nuts to crack, we have to learn to do what is right regardless of our own inclinations. Now, what we need here is a proper parental perspective. This means thinking carefully about the child, actively considering what are his needs and his gifts. You don't just let him grow up. You're thinking about things. You know, parents can in 1 minute throw away years of work if they follow their inclinations instead of doing what is right. That means, for example, doing what is right, refuse self-gratification that violates God's desires. Joseph is such a good example of this because he knew it was wrong to have that relationship with Potiphar's wife, and he refused it because of what God has to say, regardless of his own inclinations. You see, that's how the Word of God protects us from doing foolish things. Not only that, Joseph was willing to invest long hours of boring, tedious work. Apparently, Joseph reserved for himself, even though he was next to the highest office in the land, he reserved for himself the job of interviewing foreigners who came for grain. He was willing to do this for years, patiently waiting for the time when his brothers would show up. That tells you he's thinking. He's thinking about things. He's not just living his life. If he had been living like many people live, as soon as he got to the throne, he'd say, "Now I'm going to make up for all the trouble I've had." But Joseph is thinking like God thinks. He's learning to learn from God. And so he's seeing the picture. And so he reserves for himself a very boring, tedious job. Not only that, as he did this job, he operated in contradiction to his own emotions. Joseph longed for his father, but deliberately did not go to see him. You know, as prime minister, or as the second in command, he could have said to Pharaoh, while this harvest is really good, I've got the management in focus. I've got it all in place. I'm going to go up to Canaan and visit my father because I was sold here by treachery. He thinks I'm dead, probably. Didn't do that. Now remember, Joseph left home at age 17. That's chapter 37, verse 2. He ascended to the throne of Egypt at 30, chapter 41, verse 46. That's 13 years. That's nearly half of his lifetime. And you can see how Joseph would have liked to gone back to Canaan to visit his father. That proves he's thinking already, how do I maximize the benefit of these circumstances that God has put me in? He is ready to seize the opportunity from the very beginning. And you know Joseph cared immensely about his father because when his brothers would come, what would he always ask? Is your father still alive? Is he in good health? He would ask about that. And so Joseph violated his own personal, emotional desires to capitalize on what was more important than emotions, and that is to bring his brothers to repentance. Now, how much longer did Joseph have to wait to see his father? Well, he had already spent 13 years before he had ascended to the throne, right? And then you have 7 years of good harvest. And then there was 2 more years. And finally, he gets to bring the father down to Egypt. 9 plus 13. 22 years absent from his father and beloved younger brother. You see, there are times when you have hard nuts to crack. You have to be willing to renounce your own desires to maximize the benefit for those who need it the most. Notice how, as Joseph met his brothers, he restrained himself from weeping. He was lonely. He wanted to embrace his brothers, even though they had mistreated him. What did he do? He went to another place and wept, and then removed the evidence of that. Notice that Joseph was willing to take time, operate in contradiction to his emotions. He was willing to take time. He had learned God's lessons, not being in a hurry. His brothers needed the lessons, and the mourning, aged father would have to wait, and Joseph would have to wait too. You see, Joseph's perspective was, he was here by divine appointment. I don't just happen to be here. I will not waste 1 minute of it. If we want to be successful in dealing with hard nuts to crack, then we can pray that God will put pressure on the situation. Now, you cannot expect this to work unless you are growing yourself and living in integrity. The steps above, we've already looked at. When those brothers finally showed up, Joseph recognized those brothers who were bowing down, and it says he remembered his dreams. Joseph had maintained his faith in God in spite of the most discouraging circumstances. You know, if you're dealing with hard nuts to crack, you've got to abase the haughty. You see, Joseph could not reveal himself immediately. His brothers needed purging. And often, these hard nuts need abasement. In fact, it's sort of interesting when you get to chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" Can you imagine what's going on there? Jacob said, "I hear there's grain in Egypt." And immediately all the brothers just sort of look at each other. And Jacob noticed it. Why do you think they were looking at each other? Because they remember someone they had sold to Egypt. And you see, the father didn't know what was really going on. And therefore it was difficult for him to make proper moves. You see, the father needed God's intervention. God can abase the haughty. If you want to find a wonderful paragraph on how God can abase the haughty, you can read Job 40, verses 8 to 14. You know, God is describing for Job, can you do this and can you do that? Asking him questions. Can you abase the haughty? That's a pretty hard job. You know, it's pretty easy for God. And you can see the whole process here. God is intervening to abase the haughty. So his brothers come and they are bowing before Joseph. And Joseph, verse 9 of chapter 42, remembered his dreams. And he said, "You're spies." And they said, "No, but your servants have come to buy food." Verse 11, "We are all one man's sons. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies." What do you think Joseph thought of that little statement? We are honest men. Joseph said to them, "It is as I spoke to you, saying, you are spies. But we're going to test you. We're going to put you in prison to see if there's any truth in you." Notice how he worded it. Very different from how they worded it. To see if there's any truth in you. So he put them in prison for 3 days, giving them time to think. Now, if you're in prison in a foreign country, it is not a very comforting place to be. And then what he did was he bound one of them. As you study the story of Joseph, you realize he is doing nothing apart from good reasons. So he chose Simeon to bind and keep in prison. I suspect that Simeon was one who was likely calling for Joseph's death. He allowed the others to go back. And the comments that they're making among themselves shows that their conscience is still troubling them. Chapter 42, verse 21 to 22. They said to one another, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." Notice the terminology he uses, "his blood is required of us," showed that Reuben thought he was dead or at least destroyed. They admitted their sin without being confronted with it by force. And then Joseph did something else. He gave the money back to see if it would be returned. What he's doing, he's testing their claim to see whether they are really honest men. It's quite ironic because in chapter 43, verse 12, 10 brothers take double money to Egypt, and they had sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver. It's the same word in Hebrew. And then Joseph did something else to increase the pressure. He told them, "The next time you come for grain, you must bring your youngest brother. He knew that would increase the pressure. Now, since Joseph was gone, Jacob would be especially attached to Benjamin. And it would be very difficult to get Jacob to release Benjamin. Will the brothers admit their sin? It's what happened years ago. Now, what's the principle here? Sometimes, to bring solution to hard nuts to crack, other members of the family have to experience pain. Jacob experienced pain. Chapter 44, verses 22 and 23. They're talking about the pain that Jacob experienced. Now, Joseph would have known that this would be very difficult for his father. Joseph is doing something that he knows his father would not want, even though if his father understood the total perspective of things, the father would have wanted what Joseph was doing. You see? In other words, Jacob would not have wanted specifically to have his son come down. We know that. But Joseph is requiring it anyway, knowing the bigger perspective is to get all the family straightened out. You see, Joseph is honoring his father, even though he is doing something that his father would not at the moment have preferred. In other words, Jacob's new trial that he experiences at Joseph's hand is going to result in something better than he could have asked or thought. It reminds us of Ephesians, doesn't it? Incidentally, there again, you can see how Joseph is a type of Christ in that thing. And then Joseph does something else. He tests jealousy. You remember, the brothers had been so jealous of Joseph. And so it's very possible that Jacob would have doted on his favorite wife's only remaining son even more. And so what's happening regarding this jealousy? What's happening with Benjamin? And when Joseph saw Benjamin come, when that second group arrived, he invited the brothers to his house for dinner. Chapter 43, verse 16, he made a grand feast for them. And they thought that he was seeking an occasion against them. Notice how people who are treacherous think other people are treacherous also. And so they thought, he's just giving us this feast and we'll make some cultural blunder and then he'll have an occasion against us and we'll be in trouble. And what Joseph did there was he increased the pressure. He seated them according to their birth order. In other words, he showed them right there, I know more about you than you think. Now remember, this is impossible to do, because these brothers from Jacob's several wives would have been very close in age. Utterly impossible to guess what the birth order of these fellows are at this stage. Joseph would have been, let's see, he was 30 plus 7 plus 1 or 2, so he's 37 or so. So these brothers are in their late 30s or early 40s. There's only 7 years maximum from the oldest brother to Joseph. You can do that understanding if you look at the chronology, if you want to check it sometime, Genesis 30 verse 25 compared with chapter 31 verse 41. All 11 sons were born before Jacob agreed to serve for the flock, and so it was during the second 7 years, and so that tells you that from the oldest brother to Joseph was 7 years or less. Now, if Joseph is, say, 37, then another 7 years would be 44, so these fellows in their early 40s, or maybe since they're coming down the second time, it would be 46. You know, if you have men who are brothers in their 40s, you would not be able to tell who is the oldest. Not a chance. Now, what's the probability of doing this simply by luck? It's very easy to calculate, although it's a little tedious. you have 11 brothers. That means you have 11 possible seats to put the first guy you're sitting down. Now you have 10 more seats, so it's 11 times 10. Now you have 9 more seats, 11 times 10 times 9, and so on. So it's 11 times 10 times 9 times 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, and that number is what mathematicians call 11 factorial. That number is about 40 million. One chance in 40 million of getting it right. Now, I'm sure the brothers didn't figure that out, but they were smart enough to know that this just couldn't have happened. I mean, this fellow knows too much about us somehow. You see, he's increasing the pressure. And then, chapter 43, verse 34, he gave Benjamin 5 times as much. I don't know what all that meant. Maybe he gave him special delicacies that he could choose from on the platter, whatever. Anyway, he gave a lavish thing to Benjamin. He is testing them. Now, interestingly enough, as he tests his brothers, he's testing himself. Because chapter 43, verse 30, it says his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep, and he went into his chamber and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out, and he restrained himself. Can you imagine what happened? Of all those brothers, this one was his full brother. And this one had not participated at all in the treachery of selling him to Egypt. And when you see what the character of Joseph is, you can be sure that Joseph had dearly loved and cared for his little brother. Can you imagine him taking him on walks, showing him things, teaching him things, helping him not get into danger, all kinds of things. He had this relationship with his brother. This brother had never done anything against him. And now he finally sees him 22 years later. You notice verse 29, it says he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and he said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Can you imagine the emotion of that moment? It's no wonder that he could hardly restrain himself and just went somewhere to weep by himself. But you know what he did? He lived in integrity right there. He did not throw away God's opportunity. He knew he wasn't done. A lot of people would have thrown it away because their yearning for Benjamin would have been so strong that they would have ignored the priorities of God. And then he tested sacrifice. He put the cup in Benjamin's sack. And so the brothers left with their sacks of grain. And you can imagine they are getting very happy. The farther they get away from the palace, the farther they would get away from this steward that is putting pressure on them, the better they like it. And one of Joseph's servants catches up with them and accuses them of stealing his cup. And these brothers are so sure of their innocence. They said, "Whoever has the cup can die, and the rest of us will be your slaves." That's chapter 44, verse 9. Now, Joseph obviously had instructed the steward very carefully how to do this. He starts with the oldest. He's given him all these tiny details to make it work. And can you imagine, he starts and he opens the sack, not there. Told you. Next one, not there. And as each one is feeling a little more cocky, you know, "We knew that we didn't do anything, you're just falsely accusing us." And they finally get to the last one, they open the sack, and there is the cup. Oh, can you imagine the turmoil that they felt in their hearts? You see, Benjamin is hopelessly incriminated. Here are men who sold Joseph into slavery because they didn't like his dreams and they didn't like the special coat that the father had given. And now, they're in a foreign country and Benjamin, of all things, the cup is in his sack. What are they going to do? Would they leave him to his fate? Would they be concerned about Jacob? Verse 13, they kept their bargain with the steward. You remember what they had said? If the cup is found among us, he who has it may die, and the rest of us will be your slaves. So verse 13, they returned to the city. They came to Joseph's house. Judah and his brothers came there. They fell before him on the ground. And then verse 16, Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord?" I want you to notice the progression in Judah's thought. "What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found." Now notice, the brothers knew they had not taken the cup. And here he says, "God has found out the iniquity of your servants." Oh, there's a progression in Judah's thought. He's referring to something else, back there farther. There was no immediate iniquity. And notice he says, "God has found out our iniquity." It's not, "You have found out our iniquity." Chapter 44, verse 20, it's very clear they thought Joseph was dead. Because in the further recitation, he says, "This one is the child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead." You see, that fits right in with Judah's statement years before, "Let not our hand be upon him." In other words, we won't be guilty of killing him. But it showed that he expected him to be destroyed. In other words, their attitude 22 years earlier was, "We will be God. We will destroy him and his dreams." And now he admits iniquity. He says, "We will all be slaves. We will not leave Benjamin stuck." And then you know what Joseph does? He applies greater pressure. He says, "Look, you 10, go free. I wouldn't keep you. I'll just keep the one that has the cup." Oh, look at the pressure. See, they could have gone back to their father Jacob and say, "We went down there. The governor gave us a royal feast. We loaded our sacks. We left the city. And then they came to check on something, and they checked each of our sacks, and Benjamin had taken the cup. What could we do? He should have known better. He claimed he didn't take it, but it was in his sack." So the 10 could have gone free. Chapter 44, verse 18. "Then Judah came near to him and said, 'Oh, my Lord, please let me speak. My Lord asked his servants, have you have a father or brother? And we told him about this. And you said, bring him down that I can see him. And we told him, we told you that the lad cannot leave his father.'" That's verse 22. "For if he leaves his father would die. But you said that if you don't bring him down, you cannot see my face. So we told our father those words. And he wanted us to go back to get grain. And we said, we can't go down unless we take the youngest along. And so the father told about how that the one went out from him," and that's verse 28, "and surely he's torn in pieces, and I've not seen him since. If you take this one also, calamity befalls him, you'll bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave." Verse 30, "Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us, that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave." Notice, he did not say, "Your action as ruler of Egypt will bring our father to the grave." He said, "Your servants, we will do it." Do you see how he's taking responsibility for this whole thing? And it doesn't stop there. He says, "For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever.'" And now what he does, the one who is innocent offers himself as a substitute for the one who has the cup. He says, "Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers." Judah offered himself, the innocent, to suffer in the place of the one who was found guilty. And in that, he becomes a type of Christ. And then Joseph knew the time is right. Chapter 45. Joseph could not restrain himself. And he said, "Get everyone out of here." And he wept aloud. And Joseph said, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" And his brothers couldn't answer. They were dismayed at his presence. They knew he could snuff their lives out just like that. And they all knew that they deserved it. You see, Joseph, verses 5 through 8, freely forgave. He says, "Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. These 2 years the famine has been in the land, there are still 5 more years. God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. Therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father." You see, to express forgiveness too soon would have obliterated the value of the tests. Joseph was dealing shrewdly with those who had been untrustworthy. And clearly, during this testing time, he was personally yearning for his brothers, as evidenced by his need to go aside and weep. You see, Joseph forgave long ago, but he offered forgiveness when the time was right. If you want to be successful in cracking hard nuts, you need to focus on God himself. And part of what that involves is be a good chess player. How many of you know how to play chess? Well, good. You know how it works. You say, "Oh, I think I should move my bishop there. But if he does that, if I do that, he'll move his rook here, and then his knight here, and I'll move this, and oops, I have a problem. So I don't want to move my bishop there. I'll move my bishop over this way. Then he'll probably do this with his knight, and then I'll move my queen this way, and then he'll do this with his rook, and that'll be good. He'll be in a jam. I'm going to do that." You see, you're thinking about all these possibilities, and you choose the one that's going to work. You're thinking ahead. What's this person going to do? You know, that kind of attitude you have to utilize when you're dealing with a hard nut to crack. Notice how Joseph did this. He assigned himself that boring task, and he endured that task for a long time. He spoke through an interpreter deliberately. Why? So that they wouldn't have any idea that that man on the throne understood their language. And then he went to another room to weep when his emotions began to spiral out of control. And he returned the money to test their honesty. And he bound Simeon, who was likely a major conspirator. And he seated them according to their age. And he gave extra to Benjamin, and he was testing the jealousy. And then he put that cup in Benjamin's sack. And when he did that, Joseph knew he was getting close to the end of the chess game. I mean, the steward started with the oldest and went down the line, that detailed plan. And imagine that relief as each one had a sock with no cup in it. And they could have left Benjamin to his fate, but they all came back, and then Judah volunteered substitution. You see, then Joseph knew very clearly, it is time to reveal myself. It is time to offer forgiveness. And you might say, well, what if the brothers had not responded? The answer is quite simple. Joseph still had 5 more years of famine in his back pocket. You see, Joseph understood the plan of God. And Joseph had learned how to wait. And the goal was what? It was spiritual success. That was the goal. You see, Joseph's goal was the big picture. It was not righting a personal wrong. He saw God's purposes. So must we. But you know, God's purposes were even grander than Joseph could have realized. Because God wanted to weld his people into a separate nation and keep them from being assimilated into the Canaanites. Jacob's family was rapidly becoming very Canaanite in their mentality. And so this deliverance was more than a famine deliverance. It was a spiritual deliverance. And you can see again, Joseph becoming a type of Christ. And a lesson for us is, align ourselves with the purposes of God. Fill ourselves with the wisdom of God, so that we can think like he thinks and have the purposes that he has, and he can accomplish more through us and for us than we could imagine. So, if you want to be successful in dealing with a hard nut to crack, first of all, we have to deal with ourselves. Get our own heart right with God's purposes. Remove all hindrances from our own life. Have God's purposes ahead of our own inclinations, even our own emotions. And it may be that you may be misunderstood by people in your own family. And be committed to a lengthy process. I remember speaking to a man who grew up in a home where the Word of God was taught. He went off to school, got involved in drugs, went away from God, and eventually repented. And he said something I don't think I'll ever forget. He said, "The way out of the woods is just as long as the way in." In other words, you realize that this is a lengthy process. It took time to get into the mess that person is in. It's going to take time for them to walk back out of that woods. It was not created in a day. The problem wasn't. And the problem will not be solved in a day. And Joseph was willing to wait for years rather than indulge his emotions and thwart the purpose of God. And as you do these things, then lay it before God to orchestrate situations beyond what we could ask or think. You know, God used mighty events to accomplish his purpose for Joseph's brothers. To get Israel to Egypt, he sent a worldwide famine. And deal shrewdly and wisely if you have a hard nut to crack. Display forgiveness at the proper time. And remember this verse in Romans chapter 15 that we read at the beginning. Whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. That's what God wants us to learn. May God bless you as you contemplate the story of Joseph and learn to apply it to whatever situations you face in a way that's full of the wisdom of God.